Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Thomas Mott, who's a climate scientist and head of the Department of Geography at the University of Georgia. For 20 years, he's been using satellite imagery to study changes in Greenland's ice sheet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Mott.
Thank you very much.
And you've been studying for 20 years, and NASA has now revealed that Greenland's ice sheet has melted to an extent not witnessed in 30 years of satellite observations. So I take it that what's happening now is unprecedented.
It's certainly unprecedented during what we would call the satellite era, or the period that we have satellite data to look at Greenland. From what we can tell, it's probably unprecedented in our lifetime. There is some evidence that we have seen events like this in the past. People have been able to determine that by looking at ice cores, literally cores taken from the surface of the ice sheet.
So there's climate change and there's climate variability. So what is this about? Is this about climate change or climate variability?
Well, that's an interesting question. We really have an extreme event, this almost complete coverage of the ice sheet with melt during the middle of July is an extreme event that's embedded within a period of what looks like changing climate in the Arctic and over Greenland. So this one event itself is probably not an indication of either climate change or necessarily climate variability. It's an example of a unique weather pattern that's set up that happened to occur at a time of year when we would see a lot of melt anyway. But the longer-term trends that we're witnessing over the ice sheet are consistent with projections of climate change and with other observations in the Arctic.
So the reason that this is important, it has political weight, because I think the United States is the only country in the world that still has a debate about whether or not climate change is real. And those on the denial side seize upon any evidence that this has happened before, that there's any cyclical nature. And apparently the last time this happened was 150 years ago.
Last time that we believe this happened was 1889, and that's based on some ice cores that were dated at the University of Dartmouth. Having said that, again, I would go back to the point that we have this singular event. Yes, the singular event was quite unusual, something unique during the satellite era, during our lifetimes, but that's embedded within a period of increasingly frequent melt around the margins of the ice sheet, increasingly long melt seasons around the margins of the ice sheet. And if we want to talk about issues surrounding climate change, we probably need to focus on some of those observations rather than this really spectacular event, but a singular event.
So the idea that a piece of ice, what, twice the size of Manhattan breaks off, or I think there was an earlier one where a piece of ice four times the size of Manhattan broke off, that is not a sign that the ice sheet is melting.
Well, I think in many cases, from what I've seen, and I'm not involved directly in that work, that the very warm waters that are surrounding Greenland, which again are associated with the kinds of changes we've seen in the Arctic over the last few decades, were associated with that, with the Petermann breakup. It not necessarily directly related to what we were seeing over the interior of the ice sheet in the work that we did.
So the fact that something similar is happening in the Antarctic, where there's a rift in the Antarctic rock as deep as the Grand Canyon, it's been discovered by the British Antarctic Survey, that's being attributed to global warming and being a unique phenomenon. You're suggesting that these large icebergs being formed are not necessarily an indicator of a point of change in terms of global climate. And because my understanding is that once things start to melt in terms of global warming, you get a kind of built-in cycle that the salinity of the ocean changes because of more fresh water is entering the salt water, and that's likely to affect the ocean currents. And it thus becomes kind of reinforcing, and you know, you're on a sort of spiral towards far more serious problems. Is that what we possibly could be facing?
Well, first let me say that I'm certainly not suggesting that these changes we're seeing are not associated with global warming. In fact, as I said, the changes that we're seeing around the margins of Greenland are certainly consistent with the kinds of increasing temperatures that we've seen around Greenland and surrounding areas, the increased ocean temperatures near Greenland. And those changes are consistent with the kinds of things that we've been expecting to occur in a changing climate. My point was simply that the very short event that caused melt at the very highest elevations of Greenland by itself is probably not a good indicator. But the changes we're seeing across the ice sheet probably are, again, are consistent with the kinds of changes that we would expect. And certainly some of the changes that we would expect to see would be increased ice lost from both Antarctica and certainly from Greenland. And that mass is lost, the ice is lost in a couple of different ways. One way is that it melts. Some of that meltwater runs off the surface or it runs through the ice down to the base of the ice sheet and then out outlet rivers and outlet glaciers into the ocean. And the other way that the ice sheet loses ice is through breaking off or calving of icebergs into the ocean. And we would expect both of those to increase in a warming climate, and so far that's what we've seen.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Mote, climate scientist and head of the Department of Geography at the University of Georgia. He's been studying, through satellite imagery, been studying the changes in the Greenland ice sheet for the past 20 years, and NASA has just revealed on Tuesday from satellite observations that the Greenland ice sheet has melted to an extent not witnessed in 30 years. So can we combine, though, this information from the Antarctic, from the Arctic, from Greenland, and from observations, which I think are pretty unassailable, that some of the big glaciers are melting? For example, I just spoke with a friend who went up to Glacier Bay, and apparently when Explorer Vancouver discovered it, you couldn't even see the bay. It was just a wall of ice. And now you go 87 miles into the bay to find the glacier.
Well, there's certainly evidence of glacial retreat all across the Northern Hemisphere. It's a little trickier when you start comparing the Northern Hemisphere to the Southern Hemisphere, but just looking Pan-Arctic, we've certainly seen widespread glacial retreat in many locations, not everywhere, but certainly the majority of locations, in some cases quite dramatic. We've seen recent years declining snow cover. We know that June of this year had the least snow cover for both Eurasia and North America and the Northern Hemisphere combined. Granted, there's not a lot of snow in June, but there is some at high latitudes. We know that sea ice has been declining precipitously in recent years. And then we see these changes around the margins of Greenland. So I think that you can combine these various sources of information with a lot of other information, too, from observational records, from meteorological stations, actually with personal observations as well, too. I have a colleague of mine at the University of Georgia that works with Native peoples in northern Alaska documenting impacts of climate change on their lives. So I think there are many different sources that we can put together to get a complete picture.
So, and of course, I don't know that all of the dots are connected here, but anecdotally, of course, you know, I've just been talking to some agronomists recently about the droughts in the American breadbasket. Apparently, there are droughts in Australia, Ukraine, and Russia that's going to affect the world food supply. It just feels like this information is coming pretty thick and fast in terms of what would seem to be related effects from the fact that the Earth seems to be getting hotter.
Certainly does feel that way, doesn't it? Not only droughts in places like the South Central United States into the Great Plains. We've seen places where we've had unusual flooding, for example. So Duluth, Minnesota, not a place that you normally think about when you think about flooding, but massive rainfalls earlier this summer produced extensive flooding there. The changes that we just talked about in higher latitudes with glaciers, sea ice, what we've seen on Greenland. So, you know, people talk about this concept, recently have talked about this concept of global weirding or just stranger than normal weather. And I think there is something to that. Certainly we do see a number of different elements of climate that change, are all changing at the same time. And as I always talk to the general public, to my students about, it's in many cases the pace of change that we're more concerned about, or as concerned about, than the absolute magnitude of change. And it's the rapidity at which changes take place that in many ways make it difficult to adapt or to deal with the situation.
But am I correct in the idea that you reach a kind of, I guess the best description I can think of is a breaking point or a point of no return, where it becomes self-reinforcing? The more, for example, that the tundra melts, the more methane that is released, the more that the ice melts, the less amount of sunlight is reflected back into space from the white snow, and therefore it becomes absorbed by the black ocean or the dark ocean. And then the more fresh water that melts into the salt water of the ocean, it affects the salinity, which in turn affects the ocean currents. Isn't this a basic problem here, that there's a kind of self-reinforcing nature that spirals out of control at a certain point?
Well, you've touched on a couple of important elements of climate that we talk about when we're dealing with the issue of climate change. One of them is the concept of feedbacks. And you gave an example of a positive feedback where a change in toward a warmer climate is self-reinforcing. And we actually have seen that going on in Greenland. A colleague of mine who works at Ohio State, Jason Box, has done some very interesting work looking at changes in the surface reflectivity of Greenland. The surface albedo is the term that we use. And what he has noticed is places, even where you don't get much melt, seem to be getting a little bit darker. And some of that, we think, is just due to, as you get even a little bit of melt, it changes the structure of the snow. And as many people know, if they've seen a fresh snowpack, it's obviously very bright and reflective. But over time, especially if you have melt, that snow becomes a little less bright and absorbs more energy. And Jason has made the point that we've seen such dramatic changes in the albedo of the surface of the Greenland ice sheet that in many places it has become self-reinforcing. In fact, he had actually predicted that we would see a year within this decade where we would see melt covering the entire Greenland ice sheet at some point. So we have that idea of feedbacks, and certainly we can think of a number of positive feedbacks in the climate system, and many of them involving ice or snow or sea ice. The other idea that you touched on was one of what we will often refer to as tipping points. So do you reach a point where you essentially can't get back to your previous climate state? And that's a little bit more difficult to address. Certainly it's been a hotly debated point. Have we reached tipping points in terms of permafrost melt or in terms of Greenland? I think it's probably premature to say, at least in the case of Greenland, where I can speak with some authority, that we've reached a tipping point there. But certainly we are seeing signs of the kinds of changes with these albedo changes due to additional melt that would make you wonder if we're approaching a point like that where we could not essentially recover the current mass or the mass that we've lost from Greenland.
And of course, just in terms of semantics, positive feedback doesn't convey the right message, does it?
I suppose if you're using that term, the idea is that it's moving you in the same direction rather than back. In this case, I suppose we would want to be going back, but it's the term that we commonly use. I've never quite thought about it that way. That's an interesting point.
But just though, in terms of ocean currents, does the salinity of the water, because when fresh water melts into seawater, the salinity changes. Does that affect ocean currents? And we know that so much of the world's climate is based upon, the great Gulf Stream and other currents.
There's certainly an active area of research. I can't say that it's an area that I can speak with a lot of authority on. But certainly we know that as you increase melt from Greenland, you are introducing fresh water into the North Atlantic. We do know that the North Atlantic is an area where you see this deep water formation or this sinking water that drives the Gulf Stream current. How much additional melt from Greenland is affecting the salinity and how that's affecting North Atlantic deep water formation, I can't really speak to that. I will say that not all of the additional freshening all of the additional freshening of water in the ocean would be due to melt from glaciers or ice caps. Simply having additional rainfall, so if you warm the climate in an area that doesn't receive as much rainfall, you receive more rainfall. That rainfall, of course, is fresh water. And that's a significant source of freshening as well.
So given that, as I mentioned, that we are unique, I think, in all of the developed countries are still having this debate about whether or not climate change is real, and the evidence appears to be mounting. Do you think, as a scientist, do you feel that that we can get beyond this? And because obviously, the more we deny what is happening, the less time we have to deal with how to fix what is happening. And if as we've discussed, you reach a tipping point because of these so-called positive feedback mechanisms, then we have to basically get real here, don't we?
It's an interesting question. I think I've been paying more attention to, in the recent few years than I ever did earlier in my career, about the issue of climate communication and how as climate scientists, what our role is in the process, how do we effectively communicate information, and I think we're all working on it. Many people are more skilled at it than others. But I think there are several issues, I think, that make this discussion difficult. One of them, I think, is the conflation between the issue of atmospheric greenhouse gas changes and how that's affecting climate and the policy, potential policy implications thereof. So I think there's this conflation in people's minds that if we accept the science on this particular issue, then we are automatically following a certain course of action in terms of public policy. And I think that disconnecting those two and saying that, look, we can have a debate about public policy issues and how we deal with this situation, I think would help to advancing the conversation.
So do you think then that you need to sort of decouple the arguments over, how do you decouple the arguments over burning coal? Isn't it pretty clear what causes greenhouse gases? And one of them I mentioned earlier from the melting of the permafrost is methane. Are we having these continuous forest fires? That's putting up a lot of greenhouse gases at all. And then, of course, as you burn coal and gasoline in your cars, you also contribute to it. How can you talk about climate change and not talk about what appears to be the cause of climate change?
Well, I think we could talk about the cause of climate change. I think that there are many mechanisms by which one might act to mitigate those impacts. And this is straying away from certainly my area of expertise, but if one wants to talk about issues surrounding burning of coal, there may be more than one mechanism by which we would, policy mechanism for trying to achieve that end. I do think in many people's minds, and this is just personal experience talking, interacting with public, that people do assume that you're imposing a particular policy, sort of suite of policies by accepting the science. I really don't believe that's the case. But you make a completely valid point. There are some very clear mechanisms by which we're changing atmospheric chemistry, and those are things that we somehow have to find a way to address.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Thomas Moat.
Okay, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Moat, who's a climate scientist and head of the Department of Geography at the University of Georgia. For the last 20 years, he's been using satellite imagery to study the changes in the Greenland ice sheet. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with someone who spoke yesterday with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton about ways to prevent future genocides. I've got time.